Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today is Yaniv Makover. Yaniv is in Israel. He is the founder and CEO of one of the leading edge players in the space in the booming world of AI. The company is called AnyWord. This is the second company that you have founded, and we are thrilled to get a chance to talk to you today. AnyWord is revolutionizing the relationship between marketers, writers, and innovators and how they market their content. They are playing in a very interesting part of the world. And we're thrilled to get a chance to talk to you today, Yaniv. So welcome.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
All right. So Yaniv, one of the mysteries of people outside of Israel is we all know that by law you serve in the military. And the general notion is that many, many young people who come out of the IDF end up in technology. And it's a pathway that seems to be well-traveled. Talk about how that IDF experience becomes almost a farm system for talent in the same way a place like MIT or Oxford does, but in a different way. So I'd love to start our conversation there.
Yeah, I think first of all, I think there's two kind of like major ways to go from, I would say, the military into tech in the IDF. I was part of combat engineering. So basically a unit like the bomb squad. So it's not like a technical software or hardware type of role. It's basically dismantling bombs and stuff like that. I think generally the military is a very action-oriented place. So, and the IDF specifically is like, everybody gets to say kind of like what they think. So it's like decentralized, more military. And I think that trait is pretty good for a startup. And I think startup for tech. Decision-making, kind of like understanding what's happening and then making a decision in real time, acting fast. And doing that under pressure, which I think all things that happen under a startup with adverse conditions, stuff like that. I think the second thing is the IDF generally needs to invest a lot in technology just to like overcome problems all the time. And it has to act fast and it puts a team and resources, and usually it's very young people, and trust them to solve problems, sometimes saves lives. And I think so generally there's a lot of investment in technology. And it's like similar to Silicon Valley in the US, where you had a lot of engineers there in the Bay Area, you know, coming out of NASA and places like that. And that was the basis for that, plus academia, plus venture capital. That's like the basis for tech. And I think like the IDF is part of that ecosystem in Israel. I think it's a pretty good one.
So that notion of decision making under pressure, that certainly resonates. Embrace of technology, that certainly resonates. Why do you think so many folks end up in our world, in the advertising media technology? How is that pathway so particularly well-traveled?
It's one of those use cases, or I think one of the domains where you get immediate feedback. And if your technology works, then it works. And a lot of the other innovation you have to do in the startup world and tech world has to do with go-to-market, branding, scaling organizations, and things that not necessarily within the expertise or domain of engineers. It's very easy to see gains in the advertising world if you know what you're doing. I think that's part of it.
Makes sense. So let's dial the clock back 20 years. You're still a young guy, so you were a very young guy then. And in 2004, just as the internet is really starting to cook, and it's worth reminding us, 2004, we're a year ahead of Facebook, we're 2 years ahead of the iPhone, we're 3 years ahead of YouTube, so a very different world. And you're developing algorithms. Talk about developing algorithms at that age. What gravitated you in that direction? And as a layman, I'm not a technology or a science person, but how the hell do you know how to do that?
Yeah, I started actually playing around with code and coding at a very young age. So I was always into that world, played video games like everybody, and then pretty easy to get to where you're coding stuff. And in my undergrad studies, one of the things that I was really interested in is what today is like very popular, like LLMs and chatbots. Like chatbots, generally for me, that was like the most interesting AI. Like you could talk to something, it would answer. Back then, it didn't really work well. So a lot of the algorithms I was working on, and actually my graduate degree was in the NLP or natural language processing space. Actually built a chatbot for Microsoft Messenger, which was like way back. People, I don't know if they know what that is, or and it was really lame. It didn't work that well. The technology wasn't that good, but it was still super interesting. You'd ask a question, you get an answer, and for me that was always interesting. And the NLP lab specifically was the least popular lab in the graduate degree. Like nobody wanted to do that. Everybody was like interested in other stuff. For me, it was always words and how do you, and it was like magic. So just got into that space and I've never looked back since then. It's like all I've been doing since 2006.
Great story. So you end up at one of the great companies, was a very early player in mobile, Nokia Siemens Networks, and had a great run there working as an engineer and then sort of moving up the ladder. Talk about that experience. That was sort of your pre-founder days, but talk about the foundation working for Nokia Siemens laid for you.
That was interesting. That was like a startup that they acquired in Israel. And so I joined right in that phase where that startup was like being more corporate or being part of that corporate world. And it still had its startup roots. So like a bunch of hungry people building things, but part of this really big organization. So they had to like figure out a way how to do that. And I learned a lot. I learned how to build products, how to take them to the market, how to organize teams around that. And the importance of communication and a lot of processes. So for me, it was like just a school of the difference between programming and software engineering. So programming is like, oh, let's code and cool things will come out. Software engineering is like you're building something that then somebody else might need to hand like manage or build on top of. And it's a different skill. Actually, the first skill you need when you're building a startup or a company, or one of them, right? So it's not the only one. One of them is if you're a technical founder is how to build something with multiple people, how to plan around it. And so I learned most of that there. And it was a pretty good school for me. Actually, the person that managed me there, so my first boss, I later brought him into Anywhere, actually to Kiwi, to my first startup. So it was my boss, and then I was his boss. It was pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. So let's talk about Kiwi. Great, great company. Work with some of the most important and impressive, frankly, a roster of publishers that I can think of. Companies like the BBC and Forbes and the New York Times, many others, sort of marrying together the relevancy and power of storytelling, but with a new technology powering that engine. Let's talk about Kiwi, and I love that someone who you worked for then came and worked for you. That's a great story.
For 8 years in both companies, and we're great friends. So Kiwi was basically, I would say, the product of my early interest in Facebook and Facebook data. So Facebook was just like floating back then. They had a pretty powerful API. You could plug into their API and get a ton of data, which I think got them in trouble later on. But basically, if somebody installed like an app into Facebook, you could see who their friends were and friends of friends, and like pretty soon you'd have. You need like 100 users to install your app, and you had like most of the interest in the people in North America like mapped out. So I was like super interested in that aspect, and also the way people were consuming content was changing, right? So people were kind of writing content the same way in the past 200 or 300 years, give or take a typewriter word processor. But the way they were reading now content, or specifically articles, but most content was different. Instead of like looking for something in a newspaper, content was finding you in a feed. And that was like a fundamental change. And you saw an article in the feed from the New York Times or CNN. It's like you're not coming to the New York Times, you're coming to a feed inside your social network. And that was like a profound change. And for me, coming from the NLP background, okay, so now we need to figure out the unit economics for every article. Like, how are we going to get that article to the right person? What is that article worth to me, the publisher? And so back then, like, we couldn't like really change the content. AI wasn't there yet. But what I went to the New York Times, which was like a customer, one of our first customers, and then they became an investor. And I said, look, this Facebook thing, it's not another publisher. It's a browser. And this browser just doesn't have a bookmark button. which is a problem for you, right? So in a regular browser, somebody bookmarks the New York Times, then comes back to the New York Times. No way to bookmark New York Times. Guess who selects like what this user sees in the feed every day? That's Facebook. And they have two basic ways of getting content in front of people, organic and paid. And you're gonna have to figure out paid because organic is gonna be very, very scarce. And Kiwi was all around figuring out paid for publishers. Typical publisher will write 100 to 800 articles a day. They need to find out who are the target audiences for each article. They need to figure out if that article is going to move the needle for their business model, subscriptions, ads, affiliate e-commerce. And they didn't have the technology or the know-how how to do that. And Kiwi was about, okay, we'll find the best audience for this article based on the words in the article. And then we'll figure out if this audience actually wants to subscribe or click on an ad. And then when you are spending your marketing budget, you have a new catalog of content every day. You really have to do that with data and AI. And that was what Kiwi was all about. And that was also kind of the precursor for AnyWord, right? So we saw that some of the headlines in the post for some publishers were doing better than others. Some writers were doing better than others. Some A-B tests were like going well for headlines and copy. It's like, okay, words really matter to get people to interested, to get people to think about something, to convince somebody to buy something. And can we codify that into a model? And we started working on that when Saiki, we were like, how do we, and that was like LLMs, how do we train an LLM to write something that will do better or convince someone or create intent within a target audience? It took us about 2 years. And then we had a model that was outperforming most of our customers' writers.
That's great stuff. So you referenced something about Facebook and leveraging their data and user base and something that would later, you know, cause them some problems. The documentary, The Great Hack, really documented an awful lot, does not tell a great story, and mostly about Cambridge Analytica, but a lot of that story is about Facebook. Talk about early days and things that you saw where your eyebrow may have gone up and said like, oh, we can do something we probably shouldn't be able to do. Seems like a lot of businesses got built off of that, but give us your observations of what you saw. This is now 12, 13, 14 years ago, and sort of relatively early days, Facebook was just really starting to build their advertising business back then, built a fantastic business to that end, off of the user base. As you recall, way back when, there was no revenue. It was all about building the user base. When you go back to 2006, 7, 8, 9, it was sort of the pre-monetization period for Facebook, long before acquisitions like Instagram, WhatsApp, etc. But talk about your remembrances of what you saw there in terms of your ability to access data with a tool, with a plugin. And what were your thoughts looking at that? Was it too easy?
So first of all, Facebook was a really like, back then was really move fast and break things. They moved super fast and they really took a lot of risks. So today everybody kind of like sees an ad inside their feed and the ad is basically looks like a post. And when you search in Google, you see an ad that looks like other search results. That was not what was happening in 2010, 11. Like there was a pretty straight and clear demarcation between an ad and content. That was like an uncrossed line. The Facebook just crossed. Like one day they said, oh, well, our ad looks like every other post. It's just going to say sponsored in a really, really small way. And then Google saw that. I was like, yeah, we can do that too. Once they've crossed that line, we can do that. So just an example of how aggressive they were. And then they wanted developers to build on their API. And they have their, what would they call the interest graph. So the interest graph is you had a user, an ID, a name, an email, and then their interest. But once you got a user to install your app, you could see who their friends were. And that's pretty powerful. So, and then you can cross, like you could take two users and see who their mutual friends were. And you didn't need a lot of users to see much of the interest graph in the US. I wasn't looking at it from a privacy issue because, you know, it's like a developer. I don't like, yeah, so I see your friends. I wasn't looking to, I didn't have any bad intent. So I wasn't looking in from a security perspective or privacy perspective. I thought this was great. Like now you can build an app. Like the first app I built for myself was a search engine for like recommendation for books. So really you're looking for a book, like what books were my friends reading? And really like, I don't want to invest in it. And this was like early recommendation engines, like before you could do that. And then Okay. Even dating, if you want to like find like a single person in your network, that was pretty easy. Just build an app, see who is single, look at friends of friends. So there were like so use cases, so many use cases that were like super interesting to build. And I think that was the first promise they gave out. The second thing that they had for developers was reach. You can't beat their reach, like their distribution. You build something on their platform. Doesn't matter if you're the New York Times or just a startup in a garage, you can get instant scale. And you see that scale today in every social network, like which is like, you know, makes sense for everybody today. But that wasn't so easy to do before social networks. You had to have backing and funding.
So you said something, I'm an engineer, I'm a developer, I'm not interested in this. I'm trying to build that, and the information that I was able to easily access enabled me to find out, in the example you gave, who's reading what for a recommendation engine built around books and what people are reading. Isn't the problem here that not everybody has innocent intentions as you did, and that the same folks can look at it the same way you did, who might be bad actors? And one of the things I've been playing with is this notion of unintended consequences. And if we go back and look, not just at what Facebook built, but if we look back at so many of the other social platforms and on ramps to the mobile phone and to users, do you think that they were naive about anticipating how bad actors would use those same pathways, or did they know and just not care?
I think they were naive. I think it's not like maybe at some point they did start knowing. Like I think that today they certainly understand the risks and the effects that social networks have. But back then, I thought even when I was going like to meet people from Facebook that were working there, I said, "Hey, you're the new browser. You own 40% of the traffic. Like this is not like they themselves didn't understand that they weren't like buying into that kind of like thing. And these are people that were working for years since the beginning of Facebook, so." It's not such an easy thing to understand how that affects people, like the information bubbles, how people can like use the interest graph to convince, to sway people's political voting or something like that. There's just so many consequences that I did see that during the first 3 years, like they built a very strong independent policy team, and they were like, if you get on the wrong side of them, like you had like there's no we got shut down or Kiwi got shut down once. Because we worked with a publisher, I won't say that publisher's name, that later they found out that it was like owned by the Chinese government. And 2 years after we stopped working with them, they found out they were working with the Chinese government or they were funded by the Chinese government or something like that. Our API got shut down 2 years after the fact, once they found out. And then it took us like 2 days to get it back up. So I do feel like the once that they like understood that so many bad things were happening at scale. I think they took it pretty seriously. I think that policy team in Facebook is like doesn't report to anybody, but the I don't know. I think the CEO or and they're very independent. So, at least from what I was seeing, work like as a close API partner to Meta and Facebook back then, there was no way they could have known how people could use the API, the data, the reach. This was like a new phenomenon at scale that nobody saw or could have there. And I think today, when you're looking at AI and you're thinking about the same challenges, it's pretty hard to understand how this will change a lot of things and to build regulations. I don't even think that the distribution slash, I don't know, fake news reach information bubble thing wasn't even like solved until this day in the internet, right? So and we have already had like 15 years looking at this problem, and it's I don't think there's a regulatory solution or any smart thing somebody can say, hey, this is how I'm going to solve this issue.
It's unintended consequences, I think, might be the right headline. So let's talk about the evolution of Kiwi to AnyWord.
Yeah, so we were working with all these different great media companies, and they were creating so much content. And we were like telling them, yeah, this is who wants to read this article. And they're using the platform to find their target audiences and to get better, more clicks and more subscribers. And then, kind of, we saw that some publishers, not even the bigger ones, were doing really well speaking to their audience. Like they're writing about the right content, they're like the right things, they're using the right headlines, using the right words. And the difference was 14% click-through versus 1.5% click through. Like something, like they knew their audience so well that they were basically outscaling publications, 100-year-old publications, like with all the resources, and they were doing it just because they had like savvy writers, like just people that knew how what to write. They're using all these, maybe sometimes they're using these tricks. And so we thought, well, you know, this is definitely something that we can try and solve with AI, at least codify, like, how do you say something in the right way for an audience? Let's say you're trying to sell diapers to parents. Are you going to talk about how healthy they are? Are you going to, is it going to get you a good night's sleep? Is it going to keep your kid to grow up to be a decent human being? I don't know, something like that. And then there has to be a way for you to codify that. And we were always like looking at the article, analyzing it in Kiwi, figuring out what the words are in the article that actually matter, and then finding out who the target audience was. Like, for instance, there was an article in the New York Times, how people migrate to Manhattan, from Manhattan to Brooklyn, then you might target people who like Game of Thrones and Facebook. I'm not saying that target audience, but generally that was like what Kiwi was doing. Then at a certain point, you know, it really mattered how the article was written and what the headline was in the social post. And so we started playing around with a model that was writing the headlines and social posts. This was before, way before ChatGPT, before GPT-3. This was in the BERT days, like the grandfather of the LLMs called BERT. It would do like a lot of hallucinations. It would like do a lot of garbage or like spit out of our garbage, but you could get it to write a short form post text, and you could teach it like what actually works to get people to engage. And we were off to the races. Like once we saw that that was happening, then like we built a feature inside Kiwi that was outperforming most human writers. We tested it versus human writers. We asked actually copywriters, professional copywriters, to rank content or rank headlines that we thought like either they wrote or their peers wrote, which one would do better. They were like 5% of a random, like 55% accuracy. And they didn't agree with each other. And if you show them the same set of headlines 3 months later, they didn't agree with themselves. Like they would change their scoring. So humans are so biased in understanding what works that we thought, okay, like we can definitely help them out with some AI and perspective. And so we built that. I thought, okay, this LLM thing is going to be everywhere. This was back in 2019. And I went to investors and I said, look, in 3 years, AI is going to write most of what you read, or is going to help people write most of what you read. And the big problem would be not writing or creating content. It's going to be, what are you going to publish? You can write 50 variations of the same email. Which email are you going to send? 50 variations of the same ad. You can't A/B test 50 ads. And before AI, just A/B test 2 ads, it's fine. A/B test 10 variations. Now you click a button, you have 10,000 tweets that say the same thing. Some of them are better than others. And then so we say, okay, that's definitely what any word wants to solve. And that's like been the our mission is to, you know, like help marketing teams now, not just publishers, but all marketing teams, to leverage generative AI in a way that not only helps them like work faster or more efficient, but actually be better than the original writers, like the expert marketers that they had.
So let's talk about the human cost of AI, you know, on a very, very different level. I was at picking up clothes at the dry cleaner, and they recently installed these very big machines where you can press a button and a keypad and drop off your dry cleaning. And then when you come back, you can press another button and the you know, the rail that spins around that we've all seen for 100 years delivers your shirts or suits or whatever it might be into that machine, and you take it out and you leave. And to me, it seemed like an awful lot of technology for something like dry cleaning. And my question to one of the gals behind the counter was, did anyone lose their jobs because of these machines? The owner was there. And he said no. And then when he went in the back, I asked her, the worker, Miriam. I said, Miriam, did anybody lose their jobs here? And she said, no, we needed people. They've all been redeployed. They're all in the back doing other jobs. Because if they had people had lost their jobs, I was going to leave and go somewhere else. Talk about in a much more real way in terms of our industry. I'm using dry cleaning as an odd example here. But talk about the human cost of what we're doing. Are we creating more jobs because there's more opportunity built around these technologies? Or are we seeing the profession of journalism, which is already under siege, further compromised here? And what does that mean as traditional journalism, investigative journalism in particular, becomes tougher and tougher as a business? You know, we've all seen how many writers, institutions like the New York Times, like the Washington Post, have gotten rid of over the years. They've all gotten weaker. Talk about what you see there from your vantage point.
Yeah, I think first of all, we can talk about like the philosophical vantage point and then the actual, what I see, the kind of details and where I see people changing the roles. So first of all, let's talk about the philosophical point of view. Are there more mathematicians after the invention of the calculator or less? Way more. So people used to do long arithmetic before the calculator, and now they don't have to do that anymore. Mathematicians decide what the equations are, and then the calculator goes and solves them. But sometimes the equation matters, right? Okay, so what am I trying to solve here? Am I trying to solve a problem? In marketing, strategy matters. Like, who do I want to be? Who am I targeting? Why am I different? You can get a bunch of ideas from AI, but that's still something that you want to do and you want to build it. And I would argue that, yes, some things that were done in the past shouldn't be done anymore by humans, right? So like writing the same thing for 50 times, like 50 times in different ways, translation, things like that. Yes, those are going to go away. Overall, we're going to see 10x more roles or more jobs in companies, because take a startup, right? Like, you had 3 people on a marketing team. You could do maybe 1 social channel. Maybe you could do some PR. Now with 3 people, you can handle 15 channels. You can do press releases, product marketing, social, paid ads. Do you think you would not need more people to manage that? And now let's look at it from a practical point of view. So in the past 15 years, I've heard the pitch of like, even for paid advertising, like there were like companies that were saying, hey, well, I'm going to fully automate this thing. So you're going to have a robot deciding what channel to put money on, when, budgets, and change that. That's never been the case. You didn't need generative AI to do that. You had just basic AI. And why isn't that the case? Well, even there you have strategy. So for instance, let's say your goal was you're selling a product that's worth $100, or your target price in advertising is $100 just to break even. Are you okay selling 100 products at $100 or $50 at 50 products at $50? So you can say, well, obviously I can calculate the profit and 50 products at $50 is better. But that changes all the time. Let's say you're in growth mode, or let's say you have a competitor in the market, or let's say, and those things are like really matter. Like, let's say you can hit your performance goals, but then it hurts your brand. And is that quantifiable? So strategy generally is something that's not very well defined, so you can't really quantify it. And you need a person that really like understands things and have instincts, and that's marketers, right? So like, what do we care about today? What do we care about before the holidays? So I think even the very most like practical sense, I don't think even paid advertising is gonna be fully automated. And that's like the easiest thing. So everything else is even harder. Life cycle marketing, social marketing, content marketing, multi-touch attribution, all of that. So I'm in the camp that I certainly see how you can use generative AI to do stuff. Since 2009, right. I don't see how this is like replacing marketing or advertising.
Well, I sure hope you're right. I mean, clearly, I think there's a lot of precedent. You know, it was always very popular, you know, going way back when, you know, when television first, you know, rose to prominence, everybody thought that was the end of radio. And that was not the case. So I think we've seen a lot of genres of media reinvent themselves. I think we've seen radio reinvent itself with digital and the rise of the podcasting ecosystem, tremendous new energy in the life of an old medium. We've seen the same with outdoor, moving from traditional to digital outdoor. But newspaper magazines have not navigated nearly as well. You can argue, I think, very credibly that both of those genres of the media are weaker than they were as businesses X number of years ago. Some, like The Guardian, New York Times, have moved successfully and aggressively into subscription revenue off advertising revenue. But I worry about that and worry about journalism and the importance of great investigative journalism, holding people to account. And in today's world, that's an even bigger concern, I think, more than ever, politically, with all the divisiveness in the world. So, all right, a little unexpected turn into the philosophical realm there. This is an awful lot of fun to talk about. Let's look at where we are now for AnyWord 3 years in. Are you ahead of plan, behind plan? Are you pleased with where you are? And as we start to wrap, Yaniv, if we're having this conversation again in a year from now, what do you think we'll be talking about that's new that we didn't touch on today?
Yeah, I think, so first of all, AnyWord, we're super excited. We're doing really well. Like the vision that we've had for like years back is manifesting, and our strategy, our whole company strategy, product strategy, like our thesis when we asked for funding is kind of like was assuming that what's happening now will happen. So that's pretty cool to see. The I would say the big rift in the space was ChatGPT, right? So like after ChatGPT, my mom called me, like, did you see this thing? I was like, yeah, mom, I've been working on this technology for 15 years. What, like, this isn't new. I was angry. Like, what do you think I've been working on? And like, everybody, like, it was such a big force of disruption. And it disrupted a bunch of things in our space. Actually, it was pretty good for us. AnyWord was always built for, hey, we're going to be the performance layer on top of your LLM. And we're going to help you actually get 20% lift in your conversions. But you need that data that AnyWord brings to the table to do that and your workflows. But before ChatGPT, we would go to a customer and they didn't even have an AI. Or they thought, well, you know, AI is not going to write as well as our writers. So we actually had to train the market or like teach them about AI. And then if they bought in, then they would see also AnyWord's value. Now, customers are like, okay, we know what AI is. We know it works. Now we are talking about the problems that AnyWord solves, which is, how is this going to be on brand? How is this going to perform well for me? And so for us, this was like a big shift also in our product strategy, like more into the enterprise and enterprise problems. Enterprise will pay for 20% lift in conversions, and SMB just needs English. So, hey, I don't speak English. I'm from Israel. Like, so they're fine with an LLM. So this was like pretty big tailwind for us. So we're happy about that. I forgot the second part of your question. What was that about?
So if we're doing this again in a year,
what do you
think we'll be talking about that's different?
I think we're very early on in the application of the models. I don't think the models are going to move. Like people are thinking, wow, the space is moving so fast. The models themselves are not moving that fast. Like since GPT-3 till now, it's been step functions. I think what we're seeing now is the applications on top of it. ChatGPT is an application on top of GPT-3.5 and then GPT-4. The basic technology is there, right? So like, and that's not going to move as fast. The reason we're all feeling this is moving so fast is you're seeing more and more applications. You're going to see super cool multimodal applications. You're going to see people creating a whole movie from a prompt or a set of prompts, and you're going to watch that movie in the theater or on TV. You're going to see the, I would say one of the easiest applications you can actually see today that is not, we're not using it yet, but it's going to be here, is like any analyst level type of thing in any domain, like any, like I would say junior analyst, you could mimic that with an LLM. Like that, it could be a legal analyst, it could be financial, it could be marketing. Take a look at this data and tell me what's going on. And that is super powerful. You're not going to look at a data set tomorrow and not have a narrative. Data without a narrative is useless. Like, oh, it's a table, great. A narrative is what matters. Like, okay, what's happening here? Well, you know, in July you had a good month, and April is going to be even better. And you know, this segment is doing your best. And that narrative tied to data makes every data set better. People have been talking about, I have data, my data is the best. Every startup, every company for the past 20 years, and who cares? I'd go into like a board meeting. Everybody say, well, my data, like I have the best first party data. And yeah, what can you do with it? Now you can do a lot of stuff with it. First of all, you can understand it very easily. You don't have to employ 5 people to work on it for like 2 months. And that's going to like, I think, hit every domain. In our space in marketing, creative is going to get better and better. People are going to see better ads. You're not going to be overwhelmed like you think because of AI. Your feed is your feed. Like there's still a million people trying to get to your feed manually. So now they're going to use AI. You're still going to see the same amount of ads, same amount of posts. You won't mind. You're just going to see better ads. You won't see more ads. or more content. So I feel like people are scared of the wrong things. Like, you're not going to see a lot of junk content. You're just going to see better content. The amount of content is a constant, like the time you spend in your feed or in your inbox or whatever. So I think your whole user experience is going to get better. Marketers are going to change their orgs completely. So our marketing team roles and responsibilities should change, and people should think about like how to set up those teams and workflows. What are the actual roles that they're looking for? It's fine now to just test it out and like easy, like, you know, I would say creative idea type of use cases, but the team has to change, and every person in the team is now a content creator, which wasn't the case before AI. You had like people that were responsible for that, and everybody else was like channel practitioners or something like that. And I think that you have to take that into account. You have 15 people creating content on different channels, different campaigns. They're all using AI. You have to make sure that that is managed, organized.
Well, what a great conversation. And I think the AnyWord story is a terrific one. Your evolution is also a terrific story. And I think this gets a big watch this space for what will happen over the course of the coming year and years ahead. And I can't thank you enough for doing this. This was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
All right. We'll see you soon.